second straight day, closing up just shy of 100 points, another record high.
Despite the fact that we are hitting record highs, it's more a tone of resilience and just hitting those than soaring high.
The market's been slowly climbing up over a pass. We're either going to enter sunlit uplands or a desert below.
And I think we're going to go a lot higher in the Dow. I think 21,000 will be reached before we get to the end of April.
The market is clearly pricing in a big Trump stimulus, and I think anybody down there would admit if it doesn't happen, if we get zero tax cut, if we get a fiscal bloodbath in the Washington, then the market is not going to stay where it is.
Why then do you still have these economists, these holdout economists, just saying that nothing good is going to happen in the future?
Because they're insane. It's as simple as that.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, it's been another upturn for the markets this week. Most major indexes turning in positive performance for the week and bond markets settling a little bit. We've seen, however, a breakout in commodities. We've got oil prices on this Friday close to $54 a barrel. Gold, although down the last couple days at $12.30. We've got oil prices on the rise. We've got commodity producing countries seeing their currency rise and industrial metals starting to break out with copper prices up 3.5% on Friday. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining us in the first hour will be technician Art Hill from StockCharts.com. He sees the stock market still in a positive trend. He's watching energy, and that's one key breakout he's looking at to see if oil breaks out above $55 a barrel. He's also watching other key sectors of the economy, especially what's happening with a narrow focus in the market on the Qs, which have been on a stellar run here. So Art will be joining me in hour one, and billionaire investor Ken Fisher will also be here in hour one. He'll be joining us, and he's talking about his 2017 forecast, which is much, much different than everybody else. You're going to want to hear what Ken has to say about interest rates and where stock prices are heading. All of that, plus Ryan Poplava coming up in the first hour in hour one.
And I'm John Loeffler, and today on the program on The Big Picture, we are going to talk about global warming. Now, wait a minute. Don't run away. No. That's not what you think there, that whole little controversial topic. The global economic environment is heating up. There is rising economic growth here and abroad. But the problem is economic growth has been anemic in this recovery. I think GDP growth has been like 2.1% versus 3-4% of recoveries in the past, and it's gone through fits and starts. So all of that taken into account now, where do we stand in the nature of everything? What are the LEIs telling us about the immediate future as far as the markets and the economy? That'll be the first part of the big picture. And then a corollary to that is a follow-up to two articles Jim wrote back in 2012 and 2013, the Petro Business Cycle. We'll call it Petro Business Cycle Part 3, because as you look at economic cycles over the last half century, one clear correlation as to how cycles unfolded is connected directly to the price of oil. So what we're going to do is do an update on those first two ideas, Petro Business Cycles 1 and 2, and see if the whole theory of that holds true now, and if the dynamics of the oil market have changed instead. It's going to be a really good big picture today, all of that today on the Financial Sense News Hour. And turning to Wall Street and to Ryan Poplava, another week, Ryan. Markets seem to like certain things, set a new set of highs for U.S. stock indices like the S&P 500, the NASDAQ Composite, and the Dow Industrial Average. So would you say, dear Ryan, has the story changed for the market, or do we continue the narrative of growth and fiscal hope, if you will?
That's the story, John, and you know we're sticking to it. At least the market is, the investors are. And when you say growth, we're not talking about the 1999 tech boom, a new era of technology sweeping in and providing incredible economic growth, or the type of infrastructure growth that China saw over the past decade. It's simply smooth sailing, John, with earnings That is earnings growth lifting off of a multi-quarter earnings recession. We talked about that at length last year. And finally, looking at third quarter earnings turning positive last year. And now we're talking about fourth quarter earnings, and we've seen great results there as the projected growth rate so far. Mind you, we still have about another third of the S&P to report, but so far the projected growth rate is around 4.6%. And I was just checking some of my numbers, and I think around 75% of companies reporting in the S&P 500 have reported surprises on earnings, and we're right around 50%, which is pretty normal on sales surprises to estimates. Economic numbers have been holding steady, John, but there weren't many important releases this week. But we did get trade data both from the U.S. and China, and maybe we can talk about that later. But the real catalyst this week was Trump's comments on Thursday that a phenomenal tax plan would be released in the following weeks. And that was enough to really reignite that fiscal hope that you mentioned. And so we saw the market just really break through new highs. And there was some follow through on Friday with some good economic numbers. But, it's funny. Trump has promised deregulation, tax reform, and infrastructure spending. And, he's a great, what do we call it? Theatrist? An actor? I don't know what you want to call it, but he knows the game. And, every president, and it's funny, provides their budget proposal around this time. This isn't news. It's not fake news, but it's not really new news. Trump is scheduled to talk on the 28th to Congress, so we'll likely get his plans before then. And you note that Congress actually is the one who controls spending and taxation, not Trump, even though presidents come out with their proposals. It's all about what Congress wants to do. So really, Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell are the more important chess pieces here. But like I said, you got to give it to Trump. He knows how to play the marketing game. And tweeting from the Oval Office, well, seems to add some much added oomph to how he does things.
Well, learning two Oriental languages and greeting three heads of state, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, he's actually been very busy this week.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting. What is interesting, you remember that Franklin Delano Roosevelt's inaugural address, they said that Trump's inaugural address was dark, but Franklin Roosevelt actually used the word dark in his address and then proceeded to list everything that was wrong with the country and said what we have to fix. So the thing that's a parallel to what Mr. Trump is doing with Twitter, Mr. Roosevelt did with the fireside chats. He was the first president to every Saturday go directly to the American public and talk to them, and he was widely listened to. So he didn't have the media interpreting in between, what he was doing. So
that's probably best.
Yeah, and I think that's best. Most of the news is filtered in one form or another. Okay, so the hope that we see out there is real, and maybe this announcement helped investors add something tangible to the macro play, which we've been missing for just a few weeks. Of course, we have to see what the taxation plan is going to look like. It's one thing to, and then you get into the debate over it. So what else is going on down on Wall Street these days, Ryan, that is of interest?
It's right around this time, given the earnings season, it's always a kind of a micro-driven market. It's always a stock picker's market. It depends on what everyone's putting in their portfolios if you're not doing the passive investing thing. And there's been some M&A activity. A couple of mergers, I think, got canceled this week. I think it was with Aetna. And that was not canceled, but not approved. And a large number of, if we look at the earnings season, look at where the strength is, it's been mainly in three key areas: the financials, healthcare, and tech companies. A very wide range of companies in those sectors are beating their earnings estimates, and that's where I'm seeing most of the concentration of growth in earnings there. But as I said earlier, economic numbers have been holding steady. Not a whole lot to really discuss this week, except for, like I said, trade data. So I guess we can go into that. The U.S. trade data was pretty good. The trade deficit narrowed in December, down to 44, I guess down to, sounds pretty big, but down to 44.3 billion after seeing exports, they grew 5 billion, imports also grew, but to a lesser extent, and that's why the trade deficit narrowed, they grew 3.6 billion. So when you see both exports and imports growing, that's typically a really good sign that trade activity is happening. There's, it's not just happening, but it's we've got some stable economic activity going on when both are going up in kind of in tandem. It's a good sign. But the interesting item in the trade report is that it really continues to point towards, you know, what Trump's trying to do here. It shows trade deficits with Mexico, China, Japan, and the EU. And, you know, where do we see these trickle of Trump trade tweets coming out concerning those countries, you know, plants down in Mexico? Let's bring those plants back. That's been his whole MO. And Trump, he's been touting the free trade, and actually he's been touting really fair trade. It's been mainly free trade for all those countries that I just mentioned. He wants fair trade. And so he's trying to bring the manufacturing back. You know, that's been a really big major focus of his. He talks about it almost every week.
Yeah, and free trade has been a misnomer. When they were negotiating NAFTA, one of the comments I made, I remember, was, does it take 20,000 pages to say we're going to have free trade? You know, this doesn't sound like free with all the stipulated stuff there. Anyway, let's look over at China. Speaking of international trade, what's going on with China these days? There was a lot of concern over a flight of capital in 2015 and also in January. That sort of continued into 2016. So how do they stand?
China has some real capital controls in place that there's only a certain amount of capital that's allowed to leave each year. That's why typically January, when we have a whole new year, things kind of open up. And China reserves have been dropping. I saw a report recently that it dropped below $3 trillion for the first time this week. And trade data this week, like I said, it was positive, with China's exports up 6.2%. Those are some good things. You know, the market liked seeing that despite that $3 trillion number that got breached. And largely didn't have too much of an effect on the market itself. Market here is focused on U.S. and not so much overseas, what's going on there. But like I said, the trade activity improving was a good sign. Year over year, sorry, up 6.2%. And I recently read, interestingly, a Goldman Sachs report. They're predicting 6.5% growth for the year, kind of slow and steady with continued stimulus, both from fiscal and monetary sides. However, this week, John, the People's Bank of China lifted rates for repos. And that likely was done to help the Chinese yuan, which has been depreciating for quite some time, and to help curb probably some debt risk that they have in their real estate markets. You know, there's been definitely a lot of talk overall over China's real estate markets, a possible bubble there. So raising interest rates, that could cause some deleveraging, which would be necessary, but definitely not panic. You know, we don't want panic in any kind of a market. But these events didn't seem to trigger, like I said, much of a U.S. investor response in securities here. It's also hard to really gauge China activity around this time due to the lunar calendar holidays and how it can technically pull activity forward or cause it to lag during and afterward the event due to the holidays. And I guess the other China item out there is that, you know, Trump endorsed the One China policy. As you mentioned, Trump has been talking to a number of head of states, Japan, China this week. And so it seems like a little bit of a damage control, right? You know, there was a lot of tweets at the beginning of the year or even last year regarding China and trade and unfair policies, you know, manipulation of the currency, et cetera, even against Japan. So maybe a little bit of damage control here, actually talking to the heads of state and reiterating that we have joint goals here as trade partners.
Well, anything else big coming up in the week ahead that especially investors would need to pay attention to besides the real Trump Twitter feed?
Janet Yellen will speak on February 14th. So she'll be talking with the Senate on the 14th and then the House on the 15th. But we aren't expecting anything major. Look at the policy statement in January didn't really move the ball anywhere on the court. But we did hear, I think, from Evans this week that he said he wouldn't take March out of the equation, but he wants to continue to see some sort of gradual approach. I think they all do, and they're really right now in a wait-and-see mode. So I don't anticipate too much from her. That may move the market, but you never know. People will say what you don't anticipate. Other than that, we'll get some inflation numbers. The PPI, and that's the Producer's Price Index, and the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, will be out next week early, and then retail sales figures on Wednesday. Mind you, retail got hit pretty hard with a lot of the talk about these border taxes and what Trump intends to do to imports. But like I mentioned last week, there's been some other discussion about maybe lessening for industries that depend heavily on imports. So we'll see. You know, a lot of times I think Trump has these good intentions, you know, he's trying to improve trade, et cetera, this and that, but there are unintended consequences in everything, and how that actually could play on in currencies may not have the intended consequence that he originally intends. We could see the dollar strengthen and cause some disruption in exports, even based on his policies. But anyways, kind of going off target, apologize. But the main thing next week, you know, look at, I think the ECB minutes will be out. Don't anticipate too much there, but recall that they did talk about inflation figures for the first time about a month ago in December, but I don't anticipate much. Their officials have mainly been pushing back on a lot of the taper discussion, so should be hopefully smooth sailing for the market next week, but we'll have to see.
Yep, and it's always the unexpected, but we expect the unexpected. I think what we expect for the year is going to be interesting. That's the best thing I can put on it right now. So I'm not sure where that leads.
Yeah, we continue to say that Trump is really adding a component that we haven't had to deal with too much lately, and that's been the fiscal component of the economy. Very large one.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Very large one.
Yep. Okay, Ryan Poplava, appreciate it. We'll see you again next week.
Sounds good. We'll talk to you then.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at FinancialSense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Lakshman Achuthan joins us today. He's the co-founder of Economic Cycle Research Institute, where they use leading economic indicators for tracking business cycles around the globe. And Lakshman, if you wouldn't mind giving our listeners an update from our interview in last October. And at the time, you had said that basically we had been in a growth rate cycle downturn or slowdown for around 2 years at that point. And the big question I had for you is, you know, some of the indicators were turning positive, and whether or not that was going to persist or if it was just a false alarm and perhaps we were going to continue in that downturn. At the time, you said, you know, a lot of the forward leading economic indicators, particularly long leading index, hadn't yet decisively turned upward. So you said it was too early to make a call really either way. So given now that we're in February, would you mind giving our listeners a bit of an update on where ECRI's data stands and your outlook for the U.S. economy?
Back in the fall of 2016, we certainly were continuing a growth rate cycle downturn that had been going on for a couple of years already, and was part of the reason why, even though the Fed proclaimed that they wanted to raise rates, they couldn't do it because the economy kept slowing. Our forward-looking indicators were not at that time decisive on a growth rate cycle upturn or an end to the downturn, if you put it another way. But they weren't giving us any recession signals. So we were pretty clear that there was no recession imminent back in the fall. Since then, the kind of cross currents that we were seeing in our leading indicators, some going up, some going down, they have resolved to a growth rate cycle upturn. And you see it most decisively in the weekly leading index, which has very, very clearly gone up in a pronounced, pervasive, and persistent manner, quite pronounced, in fact. The long leading index, which was starting to turn but hadn't really done it in a three P's way, it wasn't quite pronounced yet, that has also fallen in place. So we have a bona fide growth rate cycle upturn that is in the early stages right now. And so if something's a cyclical turn, it has to persist.
So it'll be at least a couple of quarters of firming growth. I think that's the shortest you can have and still qualify as a cyclical upturn. And it could very well go longer than that. We have to watch the leading indicators for any signs of fatigue on the new growth rate cycle upturn. What's interesting is that in terms of the data that go into these forward-looking indicators, it's market data, government data, survey data, it all turned ahead of the election. And that's also the case for a separate cycle, which is the cycle in inflation, where the leading indicators of inflation had much earlier last year turned up decisively.
The markets are on another upswing. This has been an up week for the markets, with new records being set by many of the indexes. Joining us on the program is Art Hill. He's senior technical analyst at StockCharts.com. And Art, let's begin with the major averages. As I'm looking at the major indexes this week, what really stands out, it's another up week, another series of records. When you look at the S&P 500, it seemed like it was just going sideways there for a while. Is this a breakout in terms of what we're seeing on this Friday?
Well, first of all, thanks very much for having me on. It's really nice to be on Financial Sense. As far as a breakout, I really wouldn't call it a breakout per se, because if you look at the S&P 500, you know, we had that big surge in early November, and that was, I would call that a breakout when you're breaking above those August, September highs. And then about mid-December, the advance started slowing. We've just kind of been grinding higher. So we've been making incremental higher highs in January, late January, and now here in early mid-February, call it. So it's just a grind higher, because obviously we couldn't keep up the pace of that advance from early November to early mid-December.
So as we look at these markets, one thing that really stands out as I look at them, you've got the Dow up almost 2.5% for the year. But as you look at the NASDAQ composite, as you look at, let's say, the Qs on the market, they seem to be exemplifying leadership. I'd like to get your thoughts on some of these other indexes, because the news always talks about the Dow. But let's talk about the NASDAQ 100, talk about the Russell. What are you seeing there, and what is it telling you?
All right. Yeah, that's a good point, because the Qs are definitely leading this market here in 2017. You know, they've just made one new high after another. And I would say they are getting extended, but, you know, they've been overextended for 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks. And, you know, it's kind of a classic case of becoming overbought and remaining overbought. So we're up around 12% or 11% from that early December low. We're up about 7% year to date in the Qs. So sure, this is a very bullish move, and it's strategically a long-term uptrend, but tactically, we're getting extended. RSI has been hovering around 70 for about 4 weeks now. So my tactical move would be to wait for a pullback in the Qs, but I think it would be an opportunity rather than, say, a threat. And then when you look at IWM, which we'll use for the surrogate, or the Russell 2000, because it's the Russell 2000 ETF, you know, this one, if you look at the holdings for the Russell 2000, I think financial services is the biggest group there. It's around 25%. And if you look at a chart of, say, the regional bank SBDR KRE, it's been flat, sideways. And that's exactly what IWM has been doing, moving sideways. And so it's just kind of stuck in this tightening consolidation. And because of the long-term trend is up after a 52-week high in early December, that favors a continuation of that long-term uptrend and upside breakout. Having said that, though, even if we broke, say, below those January lows, you know, and started pulling back, say, you know, back to the 130 area in IWM, I'd still view that as a pullback within a bigger uptrend. It's just kind of a really tricky time right now, because of this tight consolidation.
When you see these tight consolidations, Art, is sometimes, and you see a little bit of a pullback, it's kind of hard to judge, is this a market top? Is it time to take some chips off the table? Or is it what has been the correct move? Is it time to buy the dips? In other words, anytime you get a pullback 4 or 5%, it ends up turning out to be a buying opportunity. Would you lean more towards that view?
I would lean more towards, yes, a pullback would be a buying opportunity. If you get, say, a 4 to 5% pullback in the S&P, that might translate into a 6 to 8% pullback in the Russell 2000, which has a higher beta. But yes, in general, I would view a pullback as more of an opportunity than a threat, because the problem also is everybody's waiting for the pullback, isn't it? And sometimes when everybody's on board for that pullback, you just never get it. So, you know, as long as IBM holds those January lows, I would be more inclined to expect an upside breakout and small caps to maybe play catch up.
Let's talk about some individual sectors. You recently did a piece and said that housing stocks are looking pretty good, and then talked about retail can't seem to hold a bid. How much of this is reflecting, I call it almost the Amazon effect, when you pick up the Wall Street Journal and you read about Macy's closing 159 stores and other major retailers, brick and mortar, kind of closing down, not having a good Christmas season, where Amazon seems to be killing everything. Let's talk about some sectors, housing in particular.
For housing, I do see a constructive pattern overall. When I say, we'll use ITB, which I think is the best for measuring housing as far as the actual home builders are concerned. The XHB, which is the SPDR, that has other home building related industry groups like Williams-Sonoma and some carpet makers and Mohawk and some others. But looking at ITB, you know, you got your 50-day EMA above the 200-day, and that's been the case since the middle part of December. So that gives me an upward bias. And then in the latter part of January, we had this big surge where we got a little bit of a breakout. And there's been a throwback here in early February, but you know, that little breakout is holding for the most part. So trying to filter out some of the noise of what's happening day to day, I still see an upward trajectory, you know, since November, December, January, and now February. So I would still be bullish on housing.
I want to look at another side of the market, and that's the bond market. The Fed raised interest rates again in December, and everybody was expecting interest rates to head higher, which they were doing. At the same time, stocks were moving higher after the election. But instead, it looks like, I don't know, interest rates are caught in this narrow range. Like if you look at the 10-year between 2.4 and 2.5, what's your take on interest rates here? Because on this Friday, we're down below somewhere close to the 2.4 range.
Yeah, you know, I know the 10-year is technically not a traded instrument, but it does reflect a traded instrument, the 10-year Treasury note. But looking at the 10-year yield, I would say it's kind of just digesting this massive move that we had from early October when it was down around 1.5% to 1.6%, and it surged up to 2.6%. And so it's kind of been moving flat. And as you said, in this, you know, 2.4% range, give or take 10, 20, 30, 40 basis points. So I kind of view it, you know, if you draw some trend lines, you can draw a little triangle. And it kind of looks like a triangle within an uptrend, which is kind of like a rest. And if we break through, say, 2.55%, then I think that would be the next leg up for Treasury yields. And that kind of move could help banks then.
You know, it's really surprising that we've had this big move. It's hard to believe that Treasury yields got down in the 1.3% range last summer, and here we are at 2.4. And yet housing seems to be doing pretty well, because I know a lot of mortgage rates are tied to that 10-year note. Yet housing looks pretty good, judging by the charts. And that's surprising, given the fact that mortgage rates have moved up about 0.6%.
Yeah, that is a bit of a surprise. What I try to do, though, is, you know, that kind of stuff, it is in the back of my mind. I do read the major financial news sites, the Wall Street Journal and what have you. So I do know what's going on the fundamental side. But I try to focus first and foremost on the actual price chart. So I would look at the chart for, say, ITB. And if I see a breakdown, then I would, you know, become concerned. But right now, I just kind of view this as a normalizing of interest rates because they were so low for so long. And they haven't gotten to what I think would be a choke level when they start choking off demand. You know, maybe that comes when you get, I don't know, above 3.5% maybe on the 10-year. That's when you might have some concerns build in.
I want to talk about another sector and get your views on gold and oil. On this Friday, we've got WTI at almost just turned $54 a barrel. We got Brent at almost $57 a barrel. Let's talk about oil itself, what it's looking like on the charts versus, let's say, the energy stocks, which have, you know, been beaten up pretty bad during this energy downturn.
2017 hasn't been a good beginning for energy stocks or oil, even though it's not down that much. But when I look at the chart, you know, whenever I sit down and look at a chart, the first thing I do is what is the long-term trend here? What's the dominant trend? And when I look at a chart for oil, I see a zigzag higher, higher highs and higher lows over the last 9 months at least. And even, you know, in December and January, you had some higher highs that were above the June, July highs and the September, October highs. So overall, we have an uptrend in oil. Now, we had a pretty big move from, like with the rest of the stock market, mid-November to the mid part of December, and then kind of started falling back. But I think it's a consolidation within a bigger uptrend. And I'm looking for that bigger uptrend to resume at some point. If we say we get a breakout around 55 in West Texas, I think that would be bullish for oil and get that next leg going. And then, of course, with the high correlation between oil and XLE and XES, the two ETFs related to energy, I think that they would move higher if oil breaks out.
Now, let's talk about something that did very well at the beginning of last year, and that was the price of gold. The gold stocks at one time were, some of those indexes were up over 100%. Here we are in the beginning of 2017, and you take a look at, for example, the Philadelphia Gold and Silver Index is up over 20% for this year. What do the charts look like when you look at gold?
Okay, when I look at gold, and a lot for gold, of course, is going to depend on what happens to the dollar and what happens to treasury yield, because gold is negatively correlated to both. So if we get an upside breakout in the dollar, because it's been pulling back this year, and if we get that triangle breakout I was talking about in the 10-year, then that would be negative for gold. But if the dollar keeps going down, and if treasuries for some reason move down, you know, below that lows of the triangle, then that would keep a bid in gold. And then when I look at the chart for gold, which I was just updating about an hour ago, you know, you have that big decline into December, but as you said, it's up sharply over the last 2 months. But it's kind of in this potential reversal zone because you've retraced about 61.8% of the prior decline, right? You hit a new low in December, so it tells me that the bigger trend is down. So I'm being very careful with gold right now, and I'm watching around the 115 level. I'll give it the benefit of the doubt as long as 115 holds on the GLD, by the way, which is a gold ETF. But if we close below 115, then I would suggest that that gold upswing has reversed and the bigger downtrend is resuming.
Now, typically when the metals move, gold leads and then silver follows. And on this Friday, we've got gold prices down just a little under $5, but we have silver seems to be breaking out. We're up 17 cents heading towards, looks like almost $18 an ounce here on silver. Any views on silver?
That is an interesting observation. And I think palladium was also bucking the trend. So maybe some of these hybrid metals that have a little bit of industrial and a little bit of precious metal prospects to them, that industrial side is helping put a bid into them. I didn't see copper today. But if you look at silver, we'll look at the SLV, which is the silver ETF. But it did get above that early mid-December high. So it's got a little bit of a breakout working, and it's trying to reverse that downtrend. that was reversing the downtrend that was in play from, say, August until December. So silver is looking more positive, maybe on a throwback on the SLV to the 16 and a half area might be the first test to give you an opportunity.
So as you look at charts, the first thing you try to assess as a technician is what is the long-term view? And when you look at that and you see higher lows and higher highs, that's telling you we're in an uptrend. So your overall assessment, Art, of this bull market, I mean, it's an aging bull market. It's been in place since March of 2009. But it looks like from what the charts are telling us, at least on a long-term chart, the trend still looks up.
Absolutely. The trend is definitely up. You know, the only negative we've seen recently is you're not seeing as many new highs here in February as you did in the latter part of November and early part of December. So there's a bit of tailing off in the participation. It's not enough to say this is a bear market, but it's enough to say maybe we're going to get that pullback that we're looking for with participation narrowing. But I don't see any evidence of weakness on the price chart. And I definitely think we're in a bull market overall. And so that means we want to use pullbacks as opportunities.
And Art, I know that, you know, they never ring the bell at a market top, nor do they ring the bell at a market bottom. Since we are in an uptrend, if we were heading into the danger zone, in other words, the ending of this bull market, the topping process, what would you be watching?
I would be watching for, I think you hit the right word there, and that is process. I think tops are more of a process than bottoms. Bottoms can happen violently and quickly, but tops are usually some sort of process. If you go back to the 2007 top, you can see that, you know, you were sideways for quite a while. And so if we start moving sideways for quite a while, and then we start having some breakdowns, while, say, the S&P 500 is moving sideways and you start to see some key sectors breaking down, leading that breakdown, then that would be something to be concerned about. But it usually takes, you know, anywhere from 3 to 6 months for some sort of a top to form.
So given what you see in the charts right now, would you be cautious waiting for a pullback, or do you think there's a couple good enough sectors that one can play at this point?
I'm watching energy because I am looking for pullbacks within uptrends. You know, tactically, I use mean reversion as a pullback opportunity, and then strategically, I'll use the trend to set my trading bias. But, you know, if I was going to put new money to work in the market, then I would be waiting for a broad market, say, pullback before putting that money to work. All right, but as far as potential opportunities now, I've got my eyes on energy. And I've also got my eyes on biotech because they made a really big move over the last few weeks. If you look at XBI, nice surge off support, and it looks like it's breaking out of a bigger triangle pattern. So biotech and energy might be an area to look at that have recently had pullbacks, and that might be ending.
All right. Well, listen, Art, as we close, why don't you tell our listeners about your software program, StockCharts.com, your website. It's one of my favorite charting software programs to use because of its simplicity and ease of use, in addition to its sophistication. So if our listeners would like to know more about it, tell them how they could do so.
Absolutely. So StockCharts.com, we offer an array of charting tools. We have point and figure. We have the classic bar charts and candlestick charts. We also have other tools where you can compare different securities or symbols, performance charts. We have relative rotation graphs. So a whole lot of tools. There's a number of free tools on the site. So if you go to the homepage, at the top of the homepage, you'll see a tab for free charts. And you can go there to do all the free charting you want. We also have subscription-level charting where you can get real-time or you can get more chart lists or more features. And we also have a lot of good commentary from the likes of John Murphy, Martin Pring, Greg Schnell, Julius de Kempenaar, and Tom Boley. So a very wide array of commentary on our website. Greg Schnell in particular focuses on commodities, and of course, John Murphy, love his commentary because he really puts it in a simplistic way to make it easy for everybody to understand. And he really ties it into the intermarket framework that he's so famous for.
I love reading his commentary. And also, I just want to mention, you also have a lot of what you call chart school, a lot of educational videos as well. Well, the name of the website is called stockcharts.com. And we've been speaking with its head senior technical analyst, Art Hill. Art, thanks for coming on the show. It was a pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Callum Thomas from TopDownCharts.com joins us today. And Callum, I want to start with the global macro backdrop and what you're looking at, because we actually just spoke with Lakshman Achuthan at ECRI, that's the Economic Cycle Research Institute, yesterday on our program. And we were talking about the leading economic data they follow. They've been doing this for a long time in terms of tracking business cycles around the globe. And basically what he told us is the 2-year growth slowdown that we've seen that really started around 2015 and into last year, that appears to have now reversed. Their long leading index has turned up. So they're looking at least for another couple quarters, that's probably 6 months or more, of firming economic growth. And also, we talked about a cyclical upturn in a lot of the global economic data. What are your thoughts on this subject? Are you also seeing an upturn in the global economy in the U.S.? And, you know, what's your outlook there?
Yes, exactly. I guess, to get to the outlook, we always have to go back and see where we're coming from. And I look at pretty probably similar indicators to them, the global manufacturing PMIs. And I like to look at it across the major regions, so the key developed economies and emerging markets. And you look at the charts for that, and yes, exactly. So 2015 through 2016, you had a pretty serious downdraft in those indicators, and pretty much actually narrowly averted recession for the global economy, and particularly for the US as well. A lot of those indicators, they came perilously close to the contraction side of things. And I guess it sort of helps to understand, I think that there was quite a lot of negativity, a lot of negative sentiment around last year. And part of the reason is that we had that negative sentiment without any actual recession is that we did actually get pretty close, and certain sectors probably did actually experience a sort of micro recession. But now a lot of that is actually turned around, and seeing some of the strongest readings for the PMIs in years, so particularly for developed economies. And I think for me, probably the three key things that I would look at, I would call them the three C's. So China, commodities, and currencies, they've gone from very much destabilizing forces from, very much 2014, 2015, and into early 2016. So, China, you've had a big slowdown there. I'll talk more about that in a minute. Commodities, you've had big falls all across pretty much almost every commodity. And then currencies, the destabilizing force there has obviously been the surge in the US dollar and weakening across a lot of emerging markets. So, China's now become a bit more, it's turned around from a detractor of global growth to a contributor, and commodities have rebounded, and currencies, they're not necessarily supporting the thing, but they've gone from destabilizing to more stable. And I guess one of the key implications of this better global backdrop is that you're getting a shift in global monetary policy. So we've already had that with the Fed restarting or beginning a new cycle, depending on your perspective. But also, you look at the European Central Bank, the Bank of Japan, the banks that were doing massive quantitative easing programs. The best days of their quantitative easing programs are now behind us. Taper is pretty much the reality for the European Central Bank, and already the Bank of Japan has likewise begun a sort of stealth tapering program. So, normally when you see global growth start to pick up, the inflation growth dynamic there tends to become very bearish for bonds. And very much if you see this kind of shift in monetary policy, particularly away from quantitative easing, which had such a depressing impact on bond yields, I think that the outlook for bond yields is only up from here.
Well, 2016 has been an unusual year. There have been a lot of things that didn't go the way forecasters wanted them to go. The Fed was thinking of raising interest rates four times. They only raised them once. In the market that was supposed to be fair and middling, actually produced some stellar returns. Joining me on the program is Ken Fisher. He's American investment analyst and founder and chairman of Fisher Investments. He's also one of the longest running columnists for Forbes magazine, and he's also a best-selling author of numerous best-selling investment books. Ken, the last few years have been difficult for forecasters. I mentioned from the Fed to Wall Street, 2016 is a good example. The Fed hiked interest rates once. The market was up double digits. Here we are in 2017. The forecast, at least the ones I've seen, is somewhat subdued, and many think it will not be a similar passive middling year. Your forecasts are more sanguine. Tell me why.
Well, first, to your point about the last few years being tough for forecasters, that's kind of an oxymoron. All times are tough for forecasters. On balance, the things that professional forecasters represent, and I've written about this for 20 years, are the compilation of all widely known information, which is exactly that which markets discount and pre-price. So if you can figure out what everybody consensus-wise believes will occur, you don't know what will occur, but you largely know what won't occur. And it's exactly not every little detail, but that macro view you pointed out, which was pre-priced and therefore couldn't occur. They had all acted on their thoughts long before they even would say them. So if you think at the beginning of any year about what professional forecasters are going to think, by the time they articulate those views, they've already placed their bets on them, and therefore they're pre-priced, and the collection of that by definition must be wrong. This year, you're completely also dead on in that the average forecast of professionals is a fairly tight bell curve bandwidth around 5% for the year, and a standard deviation out from that only gets you to about 9 and 1. So therefore, in my view, the greatest likelihood is for a much stronger market. But if we don't get that much stronger market, it's likely that you get some big bad thing that comes along out of no place that nobody's expected, and you actually get a negative market. But the notion of a middling market is unlikely to occur, because basically that's what everybody bet on.
You know, Wall Street forecast, when they make their predictions for the Dow or the S&P, they usually take earnings, or what they project to be earnings. They apply a multiple, and voila, they come up with the number. Your forecast is at a much higher rate than Wall Street. You see bigger gains in 2017 with sentiment improving. Growth persists. Political fears, which are prominent now, begin to fade. Ken, can you give us a background how your forecasts are put together that lead you to these conclusions?
Yeah, well, it's pretty simple. We just simply look for the things that we think we can see ahead that are based on both, on the one hand, the norms of history that make sense in this environment, as well as the things that are non-historical that we don't think anybody talks about. And there's numbers of things that we can say. One of them is that prolonged periods of below average returns in bull markets, year or two, typically get followed not by more, but by big. And so that speaks to big. The last third of bull markets is typically much more robust than the middle. The most robust parts of bull markets are typically roughly on average the first third and the last third. The middle is quieter, and that's the period kind of that we went through over the last 3 years in a very long bull market. Earnings will improve more than people think, and there's a spread among different groups as to how they see this. But if you just take out the negative effect in 2016 of both the losses from energy companies and non-energy materials companies, and just eliminate that, you get just simply from everything else without that negativeness, you get up into about 10% per year, a year-over-year change in earnings, which, again, most people and most, particularly almost all retail investors, have no clue of. And then normally, when we have a president in an inaugural year that is widely feared, as we have an awful lot of people who fear Mr. Trump, whether it's people ideologically or those that support him and hope he's Dr. Jekyll but fear he's Mr. Hyde back in the back of their mind, regardless, that high level of fear and concern and worry tends to subside as the year rolls on, simply because presidents, as we're finding out right now, can't usually do as much as they'd like to, whether you hope they will or fear they will. And therefore, in that environment, and I know you, Jim, have a strong orientation in the past toward Austrian economics and what have you, but capitalism just tends to be more flexible and adaptive and growth oriented than the rigidities that government wants to provide against it. And that's why over time in history, capitalism tends to prevail over governmental interference. Every time the government tries to force you to do this, people figure out how to wiggle that way. And the impact of all of that is, I think we get falling uncertainty tied to government. Falling uncertainty is good for stocks. The other part that we're very big on now, I think everybody looks at, is the election sequence ahead in Europe in particular, but overseas in general this year, which is, last year we categorized as the year of falling uncertainty tied to U.S. presidential elections and all of the people who were running in the beginning and no one knew what would happen and et cetera, et cetera. This year we're calling the year of falling uncertainty too, because of what's primarily going to go on in Europe. And while there's lots of that, including the recent emergence of Scholz and the SPD in Germany, that cause people fear there. Remember, investors are global. They're not just U.S., so we have to account for investors all over the world. Those fears, again, will subside as the year comes along. And then my big surprise for the year, my biggest and most controversial forecast for the year, which I don't think anybody agrees with. I mean, it's, I think, the easiest one to do, is that long-term interest rates will fall. And that one, you know, is the most sort of contrarian statement I could make. And I think it's a pretty easy one. Simply, everybody forecasts that long-term rates will rise on the one hand. And on the other hand, the only thing that ever really motivates long-term rates to rise much is pickups in inflation. And you got to have increases in the quantity of money. And the quantity of money is growing at a slower rate, not a faster rate on the one hand. And on the other hand, there isn't really a whiff of inflation picking up much of anywhere. So in that environment, after a nice little pickup as the year ended in long rates and a steepening of the yield curve, I think there's a very good likelihood that that just reverts back quietly down. And of course, interest rate forecasters have been, and you kind of pointed this out on short rates, but it's also true for long rates, interest rate forecasters have been as wrong or more wrong than stock market forecasters traditionally.
Now, your firm tends to be, Ken, agnostic when it comes to politics. I can't think of a time, usually the markets, as you've pointed out in your forecast, tend to do better under Democrats in the first year of the market because people are thinking they're going to do all kinds of bad things. And then it turns out they don't do as bad things as people expect. But this year, you even have Republicans that are looking at some members of the party or looking at President Trump and saying, you know, just hoping he's going to be a good guy, but there's worries about him doing bad things when it comes to trade. I've never seen so much emphasis placed on politics. The media, for example, which got the election completely wrong, are now looking at this and they're whipping up, you know, he's going to do this and this is going to be awful. He's going to do that and it's going to be awful. And it turns out, as you point out, that we find out that presidents, as we just saw with this travel ban, in many ways are hampered in the ability to do all the things they promised they were going to do in the election.
All of that's true. As I said in a column just before the election, in July I said in my Forbes column, and also I write a monthly column in the Financial Times, that if Mr. Trump lost a popular vote by quite a bit, he would win the presidency because, when I said that, several percent, I mean, I almost nailed that perfectly because it's simple math, because he would lose so much more in places like your state, California, big, than he would win in big Republican states like Texas. And when you parse out the math of how that would have to work, if he was behind by a couple of percent, he'd have to win over half of everything else, and therefore he'd win the Electoral College because those states are going their way anyway, and that's the way the Electoral College works. And I don't know, I do not understand why people never got that. But just before the election, there's quite a lot of fluidity in the polls, and my Forbes column said I actually didn't know which way it would go, but that it would be fine either way. For similar reasons. One, if we elected Ms. Clinton, it would be that you just described. If we elected Mr. Trump, I said, the markets would treat him very much like they normally treat a Democrat. That is the part where they're fearful of all of these things that he might do. People hate losses more than they like gains. It's a standard part of behavioralism, and big changes imply big potential losses for somebody at the benefit of somebody else. And the people that potentially can lose hate it more than the people who might get the benefit of it, love it. And that process of big change is fearful to a lot of people, and that fear is in the market. And then over time, as Ronald Reagan said, I heard him say this myself when I used to be a Californian, that if you're a great president, you can probably do four important things in 4 years at the most. And if you're less good, you do less. And if you spend your time doing unimportant things, you do less. So you better get prioritized and focus on the big things you want to get done. Ultimately, I don't know what those are with Mr. Trump, but that's the same reality to some extent, whether he's a great president or a terrible president when this is over. It's the same reality that he'll have to face, which is he'll have to prioritize, focus on the most important things. If he wastes his time on a lot of other things, he'll get less done, and the market will get used to that. You said that we're apolitical. We're not actually apolitical. What we are is we do our forecast based on being apolitical. People can't actually keep themselves from being political somehow, some way. Everybody's got ideology. It's just to train yourself to believe that your own personal biases, as they would translate into outcomes, hurt your forecast. They don't help your forecast. Most people get that backwards because they think if the ideology doesn't go their way, things are going to be terrible. And in fact, markets are discounters of all known information, so everybody's ideology is already pre-priced.
I've noticed that with even some of my conservative clients. They were a bit pessimistic this last 8 years, and all of a sudden now they're optimistic, when it's really nothing's changed that much. It's more their political views. You expect this year to be a great year for the markets, but you also stated in your forecast you feel it is a year for vigilance and likelihood we could have a down year greater this year, or the chances are. What are you watching, and what would concern you?
First, in step one, is going back to that which we discussed earlier, Jim. The simple fact is market forecasts and bets at the beginning of this year are all predicated on a tight bandwidth around up a little, which increases the likelihood that you either get up a lot or a negative. The negative comes instead of the up a lot. I consider the up a lot the more likely, and by quite a bit. But the negative comes by unintended consequences that no one thinks through and can pre-price right now. What might those be? Well, A, one of them is something short and sharp toward the end of the year that would scare the dickens out of the world. And there's a very large number of those ways that are very unlikely. But for example, if we came to see the world that way and you have a presidential assassination, you might get that. Untoward, terrible, tragic, but you might. But much more likely would be that all of the things that, let's say, Mr. Trump might want to do could lead to unintended consequences. If you think through some of the things that we've seen in the past that your conservative investors would just naturally find abhorrent and that have hurt our country here, things like Sarbanes-Oxley in 2002, or things like mark-to-market accounting, those kinds of features often have unintended consequences that really require deep understanding of them before the unintended consequences can become visible, a little bit like a tree growing close to the sidewalk eventually can lift up the pavement, but it takes a long time coming, even though it was a steady process. And the fundamental feature of unintended consequences, we've gone from a president wanting to do one kind of thing to a president wanting to do completely other kinds of things. And while all of those may end up working out well or smoothly or not too bumpy, you could have some of them that no one's thinking about create real unintended features. And I'm not about at this point in time to predict exactly what those would be, but when you think about all of the things that have been said, they may not be the ones that people worry about. A lot of people worry about things like the elimination and replacement of Obamacare. Therefore, in my mind, it's less likely to be there, but it could. More likely to be something that people don't much think about, like something that has unintended consequences related to any of the other many things that the president has spoken about that may get impacted in ways we don't anticipate. It's the unanticipated that gets you. So the vigilance is looking out for all of those things. And what we're doing here is spending an increased amount of time focused on regulatory changes.
You know, if you take a look at market performance the last couple of years, the U.S. markets have been clear better performers than overseas. You talk about foreign markets this year in your forecast. Certainly the valuations are much better overseas. Is this the year that foreign markets outperform?
I don't know, but I think it's likely that as we get to the middle of the year, foreign starts to become the leading force. We have 4 years in a row of U.S. leading foreign. That's the longest single stretch that's ever occurred. Normally, in the long term, it's axiomatic that U.S. and foreign have almost identical returns. That's what capitalism does for a living. That's what markets do for a living. But these last 4 years, while they're the longest single stretch we've had in a row where U.S. has done better than foreign, it isn't the absolute biggest, so that may slightly offset that. But on average, in inaugural years, foreign has tended to do better than the U.S. because the falling uncertainty happened in America in the election year and the beginning of the inaugural year, and there's more falling uncertainty overseas in the back part of the year. And so I think that's likely the pattern. But in reality, the big trends in investing in recent years, as U.S. has done better and better and better than foreign, have led more and more people to not so much focus on foreign, and therefore the time is coming. The question is whether it's this year or next year or the year after. And I'm not one who believes that because something is longest, that means it has to reverse immediately. This is a really long bull market, so everything associated with it is longer. And therefore, it may be that while I think it's likely we get a switch later in the year to foreign leadership, that in reality it's next year. But the time will come. In the long term, U.S. and foreign have to do almost identically. And after years and years of U.S. doing better, I mean, if you just go back to history, and you can go back to history as long as you want, every few years they keep flipping between U.S. versus foreign leadership. And that trend, not on a regular predictable basis, but that trend of 2 years here, 3 years there, occasionally four, 1 year here, 1 year there, U.S. does better than foreign, foreign does better than U.S., U.S. does better, always going the same way, but one doing better, one lagging, flipping a few years later, we're going to get back to that point. And when we flip, there are going to be an awful lot of people that will be caught by surprise because they've been kind of piling onto the U.S.-only bandwagon.
You talk about successful investing as many times more about probabilities than possibilities. And you said something in your 2017 forecast, which we share.
You've really studied my stuff. That's amazing. Almost no one ever does that.
I read all your stuff, Ken. But anyway, in 2017, you stated something that we share a very similar opinion, and that is 2017 is the year to expect the unexpected. Anytime, and I got a lot of this, I have to admit, from reading a lot of your books over the years, is when you see this consensus this year, which is, I call it fair to middling, we'll maybe do 4 to 5%, you usually see just the opposite, as you pointed out. You either have a year that is spectacular, that surprises everybody, 2016 being a good example, or you get a year that nobody expects and things are greater on the downside. And you can almost see both possibilities this year. So let's talk about the year to expect the unexpected, because really what you're saying here is this fair to middling 4 to 5%. See, to me, that is sort of hedging your bets when I see those kind of forecasts. We're not really sure what's going to happen. Let's stay with something real conservative, 4 or 5%. We're not going to get hurt, rather than say, no, I think this could be a super year. Or conversely, if you're really bearish, no, I think this could be a bad year.
Well, the simple fact, as you alluded to but didn't say in so many words, is that the history of the market is that average returns are not normal and normal returns are extreme. And it's a small percentage of history that have had returns sort of in the 0 to 10% range. And most of history has either been at returns markedly higher than that or somewhat negative to a lot negative. And the average is made up of those extremes, and people can't quite get themselves to go that way because they tend naturally, coming from a background where we all derive from being natural critters in a natural world to think in terms of averages and norms. And if it's too hot, it's got to get colder. And if it's too cold, it's got to get warmer, all of which work in the natural world most of the time. But markets are inherently nonlinear. And it's the unexpected that always gets you. It's the difference between expectations and reality that causes the surprise that always moves markets. And that's the reason why in this year, while I expect the surprises on the positive side, it's also possible that something big, bad, ugly that cannot be pre-priced comes along that none of us are talking about. But I want to take a sidestep from that, Jim. All the things that everyone is talking about won't do it because they're the things that are pre-priced. So when you see all of the noise that people talk about, and of course, as you say very correctly, there's more noise than I've ever seen at a moment in time about politics right now after an election, more noise after an election than I've ever seen before. And there's very clearly a kind of a war going on between the administration and the media that doesn't seem to want to abate. Eventually it will. And it's all the things they're talking about that won't move the market. The noise that they have and all the rest of the noise you see on the internet and things related will blanket out the thing we have to watch for, whatever it is. And one of the things that I said eons and eons and eons ago is if you can see, you can use media as an indicator. I wrote this in Forbes in 1995, believe it or not. You read media necessarily to find out what people are fixated on so you know not to pay attention to it. And you pay attention to other things. And so it's all of that other stuff that you won't read in the papers. And people have a very hard time with that because they have a hard time gathering information away from the media. And the media has just become terrible in the last 15 years. The media is so much more myopic and noise-oriented than it was 15 years ago as their profitability has fallen. They're trend chasers and eyeball catchers. And, you know, used to be that if it bled, it led. But now, you know, they really want it not just bleeding, but gushing with body parts coming out to lead. And people get fixated on looking at that stuff, which is actually self-injurious. And the reality is the biggest likelihoods to have problems come out of not those things that we talk about. Look at all the surprises last year, and you know this. Look at all the people that said that if Brexit passed, A, the markets would be terrible on the one hand and Britain would implode. In fact, quite the reverse happens. Not that we were predicting Brexit would pass, we weren't. But what we said was that if Brexit passed, it wouldn't be a big deal because everybody was focused on that. Brexit passes, Britain goes on, Britain market actually does better than the European market in the subsequent time period, and Britain's economy last year was the strongest of any developed Western nation. Gee, how could that be so different? How could that be so wrong? And where is the media saying, oh my gosh, we were wrong about everything. And the same, of course, being true of Mr. Trump. When Mr. Trump was elected, you know, they all said, if Mr. Trump is elected, the markets will implode. And you remember the way the market reacted overnight, but just overnight. And this part of our society today is so heavily dosed with that media noise. People have a hard time getting themselves to learn to turn away from it and focus on the real world. The good news, however, and I think this is a reason to be bullish, the good news is that you can measure through a variety of sources, going back over years, done the same way consistently over time, that credibility in the media has fallen, and falling at a faster rate. And particularly in the last year, it's fallen as so much of what the media has fixated on has kind of come to pass exactly backwards from what the media has been speaking to. In that regard, the more the credibility of the media falls, the more people rely on their own experiences to make judgments. And the more they rely on their own experiences to make judgments, in my opinion, in this world, which is not nearly as bad as people think it is or fear it is or read it is from the media, they're very likely to react to what's immediately around them positively, which leads, I think, to an increased likelihood of the beginning of what Alan Greenspan used to refer to as animal spirits. And animal spirits are kind of what you need to get a bull market going at a higher rate.
You know, both of us are the same age. We've been around. We've seen bull markets.
Oh, we're not the same age. You're an old goat compared to me. For listeners that don't know, Jim's a month older than I am.
Okay. But as you look at the markets, Ken, I have yet to see a market that ends as many are predicting when people aren't as euphoric as you typically get. I mean, I think back to the year 1999 and 2000, or even in the latter months of 2007, when everybody was going to make fortunes in real estate in the market. We haven't seen as much of that in this market.
Yeah, I agree with you. And the only qualification that I would make to that is sometimes the euphoria isn't so totally clear. Maybe it's in the West Coast marijuana gold rush. I don't know. But there's not a visible sign that's easy for me to identify of the euphoria present. That's right. That's the famous John Templeton line that I quote so often, that is, bull markets are born on pessimism, grow on skepticism, mature on optimism, and die of euphoria. And we certainly, as of this last year, we're stuck in a trade-off between skepticism and optimism. And I think now we're in the optimism phase, but we're a long ways from the euphoria phase. We're in the optimism phase with a little bit of skepticism still tied to, is Mr. Trump going to be a disaster?
You know, one thing that we were talking about before we went on the air is every bull market has a trend and a fad. The things that are very popular today are ETFs, or what we call passive investing. You contend a lot of today's passive investing isn't as passive as most people think. Explain.
Well, almost no one, not no one, but almost no one actually invests truly passively. They just use passive tools to invest actively. And by that, I mean, whether it's buying just the S&P 500 through something like the SPDR or some combination of ETFs, they buy things that they think will do well for them. And then in some period ahead, not terribly long in time, could be a year, could be 3 years, when those things end up not doing well, they dump them at the bottom and they either move to something that's another form of passive vehicle that's been hot, or they just give up on the passive thing and move on to whatever the next stupid thing is that they want to do. The real trend, and I mentioned this in a different way earlier, in the last few years has been to move to U.S. only passive, because U.S. has been doing better than foreign. That works as long as it works. At the point in time where foreign starts to do better than U.S., lots of these people after a year or two will become disenchanted with what they had done, may not or may move to foreign, but either way, they're going to get whipsawed. They get whipsawed by moving to foreign too late. They get whipsawed by getting out of U.S. only at the bottom. But most people, you know, there's this very long history that's been documented forever in a parallel mode where investors in no-load funds do worse by far than the no-load funds do, because they in and out of them at all the wrong times. And you buy the growth fund when it's hot, and you buy and you sell out when it's not, and then you buy a bond fund at the wrong time, and you buy the value fund at the wrong time, and the foreign fund, and the emerging market fund. And it's that trading the vehicles backwards that hurts so much, but it's so easy to do that with passive because it's cheap, it's easy to trade. You buy this thing that's been doing well, and nobody thinks through the fact when they're buying S&P 500 only passive, which has been the trend in the last few years, that they're riding a trend. And when the wave goes down, they're going to go down with the wave, and the passiveness doesn't protect them from that at all. And then they change their mind, and when they change their mind and move out of it, they're no longer passive.
You know, you have been a prolific writer as long as I've known you. You've written for Forbes for 32 years. You've written numerous books. Your last book, Beat the Crowd, in 2015, I think I asked you at that time, was that your last book, or is there another one percolating in your mind?
There is not one percolating in my mind, but that doesn't mean there won't be. What I've always had is the view that a book justifies a major idea somehow, some way. And if I don't have what I think is a good major idea, there's no point in writing a book. I have not had since that book another major idea that I thought was worthy of a book. Otherwise, you know, I write a lot of stuff, as you say, whether it's in this place, that place, or the other place. And I have lots of ideas that I think are worth one page, but that's real different than 250 pages. And you need a major idea to warrant wasting somebody's time on 250 pages. I've written 11 books and 4 New York Times bestsellers, and I really don't want to write a book. Not necessarily that it has to be a New York Times bestseller, but I don't want to write a book unless I think it makes a major contribution. And if either 7 people are going to read it, or It doesn't have something of importance to whoever would read it. I don't want to waste my time. I'm not cranking out books to crank out books. I got plenty to do. And, you know, at our age, Jim, more and more time becomes important to you. When you're young, you know, you want to do everything fast and you want to do everything new. And at our age, the most valuable commodity that I personally have, and I suspect the same is true for you, is time to spend on the most important things that still remain in what I hope is a long life but gets ever closer to the end of it. And, you know, I'm not going to waste my time on something unless I think it's important.
Well, I loved your last book. It's called Beat the Crowd, and I highly recommend investors. And another one of my favorites, The Three Questions That Count. Ken, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. Our listeners can follow you. You write a column in Forbes and also write for the Financial Times. And, of course, they can find out more about you at Fisher Investments. Ken, all the best to you and a happy new year.
Ditto to you, and thanks much for having me. I appreciated it. You're fun.
Coming up next, the conversation will turn towards global warming. The global economic environment is heating up, and people don't seem to be talking about the global environment in that area. We've had rising economic growth both in the United States and abroad, even though economic growth has been anemic during the course of this whole recovery, around 2.1% versus 3 or 4 of previous recoveries. Nevertheless, things are heating up. So what does this mean? What are the LEIs telling us right now where we're headed? Because the market seems to like what's going on. Will that last? And how does it factor in with things like debt and promises from the new administration about tax relief for individuals and corporations, government fiscal spending, and rolling back on regulations? And also, how does that correlate with the petro business cycle? We'll re-examine Jim's major pieces, Petro Business Cycles 1 and 2 from 2012 and 2013, and see if those principles are still valid for showing the harbingers of markets up and down. All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense NewsHour continues at financialsense.com.